Some of us have been examining the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra this practice period. An epic sutra of great length that's mainly teaching Buddha nature, also known as the true self. But because the sutra is so epic, there's a lot of other stuff going on there too. So tonight, I'd like to bring up some stories from this sutra that have made their way into the Zen tradition. Like a lot of Zen ancestors appreciated this sutra and used pieces of it for their teaching. So Dogen Zenji is one of those who picks up on pieces of the sutra and comments on it. Because several of Dogen's essays are kind of based on parts of the sutra. Dogen has an essay called Buddha Nature that's woven around various quotes from this Parinirvana Sutra, as well as some other stories about Buddha Nature. But tonight, I'm not going to talk about Buddha Nature, I don't think, so much. We'll hear some of these other stories. One is about the four horses. Dogen also has an essay called Four Horses that's based on this sutra and some others. So here's the Parinirvana Sutra, Buddha speaking about this analogy of four horses. Buddha says, good people, there are four ways to command a horse or train a horse. Touching the hair, touching the skin, touching the flesh, and touching the bones. The horse always follows the rider's command according to where it's touched. The Tathagata, the Buddha, likewise trains or commands sentient beings in four ways. First, the Buddha speaks of birth for sentient beings who accept his words, just like the horse follows the rider's command by being touched on the hair. So just the edge of the hair tips of the horse, the rider can just brush the edge of the hair by speaking about birth. And that's enough to prompt the horse to go. And in this kind of metaphor, the horse going is like a disciple of Buddha wholeheartedly practicing the way. So it's enough to prompt us to practice the way to just hear about birth. It's like being touched on the hair. Second, the Buddha speaks of birth and old age for sentient beings who accept his words just as the horse follows the rider's command by being touched on the hair and the skin. So sometimes a horse needs to hear about a little bit more than birth before they start to wholeheartedly practice. They have to hear about birth and old age. So it's like you have to kind of press a little harder, strike a little harder past the hair onto the skin of the horse. Third, the Buddha speaks of birth, old age, and sickness for sentient beings who accept his words, just as the horse follows the rider's command by being touched on the hair, skin, and flesh. Finally, the Buddha speaks of birth, old age, sickness, and death for sentient beings who accept his words, just as the horse follows the rider's command by being touched on the hair, skin, flesh, and bones. Good people, there's no fixed way for a rider to command the horse. The way the Tathagata, the world-honored one, guides sentient beings is never in vain. Thus, the Buddha is called the excellent tamer of sentient beings. That's in chapter 25 of the Parinirvana Sutra, page 241 in our Yamamoto translation. And then Dogen says, this is called the Parinirvana Sutra's four types of horses. There's no students who do not study this teaching, and there are no Buddhas who do not speak of it. So, do you get the gist? Sometimes it's enough just to hear about the problems of birth to get us to start practicing. Just a little brush on the edges of our hair by the Buddhas. Sometimes, like, birth doesn't seem so bad, but birth and old age strikes a little deeper, and birth, old age, sickness goes to the deeper flesh. Birth, old age, sickness, and death. When we hear about all those, they really strike us to the bone. And if we're a kind of a horse that's trying to ignore various signals from the rider, when we hear birth, old age, sickness, and death, really take it to heart, and then we want to practice to address these difficult situations of human life. And it's not really that that any of these horses are better or worse. We might think, well, we could save some pain of being kind of struck to the bone if we just start to really look at our life and practice when just hearing about birth. That's not necessarily better. Suzuki Roshi talks about these four horses in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's also brought up in other sutras. And Suzuki Roshi says, sometimes what looks like the best horse is actually the worst horse, and what looks like the worst horse is the best horse. Maybe somebody who just hears a little bit and jumps into practice by just having their hair brushed, touched a little bit by something in their life, they maybe don't sustain it, but maybe the horse that takes a long time to get going and really has to face a lot of pain and difficulty before they really commit to practice, maybe they end up being the best horse in the long run. You gotta have a slower start, but they stay with it longer, maybe. I think this is what Suzuki Roshi means. The Buddha, in speaking of his own life, I think a lot of you probably know the story of the Buddha being very sheltered in his early childhood. His father didn't want him to see old age, sickness, and death. And so he kind of like got all the old age, sickness, and death people kind of like out of the immediate palace grounds, and kind of wanted to shelter his son from seeing these things, because he was afraid if his son saw these things, he might want to go be one of those wandering yogis and who are looking for a way to work with old age, sickness, and death. And his father wanted him to stay in the palace, so let's try to avoid looking at old age, sickness, and death. And then according to to the tradition, we say that there were these divine messengers called old age, sickness, and death. Sometimes it's spoken of as divine messengers because, like, the divine beings who wanted the Buddha to practice the way and become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings, they're like, this kid's got to see some old age, sickness, and death if he's going to practice the way and be a Buddha. So let's try to, like, use our celestial powers to sneak some old age, sickness, and death into the palace for the young prince to see. And when the Buddha did eventually see an old person, a sick person, and a dead person, and realized that this was his own fate as a sentient being, it really turned him. It struck him to the bone. The Buddha said, when I saw old age and realized that that was what was going to happen to me too, the vanity of youth vanished for me. And when I saw sickness and knew that that would also happen to me, the vanity of health vanished. And when I saw death and knew that was going to happen to me, the vanity of life vanished for me. And thus, he set out on his quest to realize the deathless, the sickless, and the ageless. It seems that in order to realize the deathless, the sickless, and the ageless, one has to become very familiar with aging, sickness, and death, not avoid them or deny them, try to pretend they're not the case until they're really in our face, but really accept them, come to accept that this human condition is one of aging, sickness, and death. And if we can really come to accept, deeply accept, this is hard work, right? This is a lifetime of practice. If we can accept our own aging, sickness, and death as a nature of a sentient being, an impermanent sentient being, then right there in the complete acceptance of old age, sickness, and death, we may be able to see the deathless, the sickless, and the ageless. I wouldn't go so far as to say that complete acceptance of old age, sickness, and death is the deathless, the ageless, and the sickless, but that unborn, unconditioned nature is right there with the complete acceptance of the conditioned nature. We can't kind of like, well, I just want to find the unconditioned nature. Let's kind of just try to avoid the old age, sickness, and death. That's like, if we're kind of fighting and resisting the images of old age, sickness, and death moving about the surface of the mirror, we're never going to be able to notice the surface of the mirror. But if we can completely accept, yes, these images of old age, sickness, and death dancing about the surface of this mirror, I completely am not into manipulating them or doing anything to fix them now, then maybe we see the mirror that's right there holding these images of old age, sickness, and death. The deathless mirror, the unchanging source of impermanent aging, sickness, and death. And also by accepting our own aging, sickness, and death, we can open to others' difficulty with aging, sickness, and death. Someone just today told me that in his grieving for a lost loved one, he's really able to connect with others who've lost loved ones in a way that he never had before. Now I really know what you're going through, and I'm going through it too, and we all are. I think that was part of the Buddha's realization when he was still in the palace, when the vanity of youth and the vanity of health and the vanity of life left him. You could see this is the condition for all of us. All of us sentient beings, all of us impermanent sentient beings, subject to aging, sickness, and death. But is there an unconditioned, undying, unborn nature? And that's a lot of what this Parinirvana Sutra is about. That's the story of the four horses from the sutra. Moving on, I have another story that the Zen tradition picked up on quite a bit. This is a story of Saindava. And Jean brought up this Saindava story some weeks ago. It's from this Parinirvana Sutra, chapter 16. Page 132. And Dogen also has an essay called "The King Asks for Saindava." You'll hear about Saindava in a minute. So that's another essay that's kind of based on the sutra. So here's the original story from the sutra. It's like this. It's another kind of parable. The Buddha says, what the Tathagata says with the kind of hidden meaning is profound and not easy to grasp. It is like the case of a great king who asks his attendant, or like minister, say attendant here, to bring him Saindava. And Saindava is apparently products from the Sindhu River basin in India. Currently the Sindhu River is modern times called the Indus River, which is one of the huge rivers along with the Ganges that runs through India. And in the old days it was called Sindhu River, so in the Sindhu River basin, the Sindhu products were called Saindava, various Sindhu products. Sindhu born, I think literally is Saindava. So there's various products from this Sindhu region. So there's various things called Saindava. We have to use this word here because, as you'll hear. So this great king asks his attendant to bring him some Saindava. The word Saindava, the sutra says, has four meanings. First, it means salt. Secondly, it means cup or vessel. Third, it means water. And fourth, it means horse. So in this part of India, all these things that come from the Sindhu Valley are called Saindava. Thus, four things have the same name, but a wise attendant knows the intended meaning of this word, Saindava, So when the king is washing and calls for Saindava, the attendant gives him water. When the king is eating and calls for Saindava, the attendant brings salt. And when the king's finished eating and wants to drink something and calls for Saindava, the attendant brings a cup. And when the king then wants to go somewhere and calls for Saindava, the attendant brings the horse. Thus, the wise attendant well understands the meaning of the great king's words. This is the same with this Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra. There's four aspects of conditioned things, you might say. So the Buddha is now going to make the parallel to his teaching. The wise attendant of the Mahayana, of the great vehicle, should know these aspects of conditioned things. If the Buddha appears in the world and says that he's going to enter nirvana, enter parinirvana mean like leave this world, like the body is going to die for the Buddha. The Buddha is going to leave this world. If the Buddha appears in this world and says he's going to leave this world and enter parinirvana, the wise attendant should know that the Tathagata is speaking of impermanence. For those who adhere to the permanent existence of things, to help people realize the impermanence. So it's kind of like, I think it's implied here that that's sort of like a, there's sort of a hidden meaning here, because a lot of what the sutra is saying is that the Buddha is not impermanent. There's the eternal body of the Tathagata. So when the wise attendant hears the Buddha saying, the Buddha seems to appear in the world and say he's about to leave the world, the wise attendant knows that it's kind of almost like a skillful means to say that that the Buddha is impermanent, like all sentient beings, and is going to leave this world. For those who are particularly attached to the illusion that conditioned things are permanent. So it's kind of like a Saindava teaching, that one understands the kind of inner meaning or hidden meaning that the Tathagata is not really impermanent, but it can appear this way. Secondly, the Buddha might say that a blissful experience is about to end. And a wise attendant should know that the Tathagata is speaking of discontent or suffering, dukkha, to those who adhere to blissful experiences, to encourage the practitioners to understand the truth of suffering, discontent with all experiences. Those who are holding on to a blissful experience and don't want to let it go, he teaches that all experiences, blissful experiences, are going to end and become unblissful or dissatisfying. Thirdly, the Buddha might say, I am now sick and in pain, and all people, including myself, will die. And the wise attendant should know that the Tathagata is speaking to those adhering to a separate self, those who are holding on to a separate self, like the Buddha saying, I am going to die and I'm sick and in pain. So that those holding that some conditioned person is an actual permanent self, he teaches this so people can open to the teaching of not self, that all conditioned sentient beings are not a true self. Again, with the kind of hidden meaning that there's a true self, which is a major topic of this sutra, that doesn't die. And then the Buddha might sometimes also teach that all conditioned things are impure, means that they're tainted by our conceptual dualistic thought, and no conditioned experience could ever be totally pure and free from dualistic grasping and fixation. So the Buddha teaches all conditioned things are impermanent, dissatisfying, not self, and impure, with a kind of hidden meaning, sort of like it's a skillful means to help people who are attached to conditioned things, conditioned experiences being being like permanent and ultimately satisfying and truly a real self and truly pure. But in the sutra, the Buddha says there is a permanent and eternal, there is a bliss, a true unchanging bliss. There is a true real self, a true Atman, and there is a true purity. But these are not qualities of conditioned phenomena. These are the unconditioned, true nature of all beings, also called Buddha nature in the sutra. So after this, the Buddha says, the Buddha also may say, all beings have Buddha nature. And the wise attendant should well know that the Tathagata is speaking of the eternal truth and wants the practitioners to understand the true characteristic of eternal Dharma, or eternal truth. Anyone who thus practices the way may know that she is truly my disciple. She indeed understands the hidden storehouse of the Tathagata, the hidden Tathagata garbha. Just as the attendant well understands the great king's mind. O good people, thus this great king has a hidden meaning when he asks for sandava. The attendant doesn't know the meaning of sandava by just this word, because it has four meanings, right? And how could it be that the Tathagata doesn't have such a hidden meaning? Hence, it's hard to know this hidden meaning of the Tathagata. Only the wise ones can reach the depths of what I teach. So that's the story of sandava in the Parinirvana Sutra, the four types of sandava. So it looks like in the sutra that it's kind of like, I would understand the context here is like it's referring to the skillful means that the Buddha uses to teach that all conditioned things are impermanent and not self and ultimately dissatisfying and impure, or tainted by dualistic fixation. That's kind of his hidden teaching, whereas the revealed teaching could be the eternal, the true self, the pure and the blissful. We could also see it the other way, that's the hidden Tathagata garbha. Tathagata garbha is another name for Buddha nature. That's the hidden, and the explicit teaching is what we usually think of as Buddha's teaching of the impermanent and the not-self and so on. He's pointing out that when we see one side, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. The other side of the story is kind of hidden. Now, Zen ancestors got a hold of this Saindava story, and they kind of turned it a little new way. They didn't refer to these four qualities of conditioned phenomena and four qualities of unconditioned reality. Instead, they just used the story to refer to kind of how we use words. Just like the first story about the four horses was kind of about hearing teachings and how we have sometimes have to hear more and more for it to really strike the bone. Saindava story is about this kind of understanding what's meant by the Buddha's words. But in the Zen context, maybe gets turned a little bit to be like a kind of intuitive understanding of what the teacher is trying to convey. So I think it's similar to the sutra, but it's the Zen twist is bring me Saindava, a good disciple, has some intuitive sense of what the teacher is looking for right at that time. So, for example, well, here's an early reference to Saindava from Baijiang, who was one of the early golden age of Zen ancestors. And he's talking about the true self is like veins of gold, like pure gold, surrounded by muddy ore. Ore is like the stuff that surrounds gold, like the dirt and all that's around the gold. So all things, existent and non-existent, ordinary and sacred, all phenomena are like the ore that's around the gold, and the true self is like the pure gold. And when you separate the gold and the ore, then the gold is exposed. In other words, if you can make a distinction between all conditioned phenomena and the true self, then the true self is revealed. If there's someone who's seeking for money or treasure, then you can turn the gold into money and give it to them. So this is kind of like a bodhisattva teaching. Or if you discover your true, pure, eternal self, unconditioned self, then you can turn that into anything to help people. So if there's someone seeking money or treasure, you can turn the gold, remember gold here is a metaphor for your true self, you can turn it into money and give it to them. It's like wheat flour, pure without any bugs or anything in it. If someone wants cake, you can turn this flour into cake and give it to them. It's like a wise attendant who skillfully interprets the meaning of the king. When the king's going to travel and asks for Saindava, then the attendant brings a horse. At mealtime, the king asks for Saindava and the attendant brings salt. These are ways that people who study the hidden essence are able to benefit beings by bringing out the Saindava that all beings are looking for. So that's kind of an early Zen reference to Saindava. But in Dogen's essay called The King Wants Saindava, Dogen tells the story from the Parinirvana Sutra, and then says, this story of the king wanting Saindava and the attendant bringing it has been handed down for a long time. This story has been transmitted just like a Dharma robe. As the world-honored one did not fail to bring it up, his descendants often quoted him, like Dogen does, and like you're hearing tonight, the story of Saindava. The Saindava subtly permeates the house of Buddhas and ancestors, just as it did in the house of the great king. So here's another story. Now Dogen brings up a monk asked Jiaozhou, another one of the great golden age Zen teachers. A monk asked Jiaozhou, what about the moment when the king wants Saindava? And Jiaozhou bowed forward and held his palms together. That's the story. This is like, you can see how this sutra story of Saindava is turning into a kind of Zen thing. What about when the king wants Saindava? Jiaozhou bows with his palms together. And then Dogen says about this, study the meaning of Jiaozhou bowing and holding his palms together. At this moment, is this the king wanting Saindava, or is it the attendant bringing Saindava? Was the monk asking Jiaozhou for the Saindava, or is it now Jiaozhou demonstrating how to ask for Saindava? It gets kind of dynamic in the Zen world. Dogen goes on to say that the world honored one wanted Saindava, the Buddha wanted Saindava, and Mahakashyapa smiled. You know that story? The Buddha held up a flower and Mahakashyapa smiled, and that was the first Zen transmission. So here Dogen says, the world honored one wanted Saindava, and Mahakashyapa smiled. That was his way of bringing Saindava. Bodhidharma wanted Saindava, and his four disciples brought the horse, the salt, the water, and the cup. Yeah, there's a story about Bodhidharma kind of asking his four disciples to express the teaching, and they all expressed it in a slightly different way by bringing the horse, the salt, the water, and the cup. Dogen says, study the key point that when the horse, the salt, the water, and the cup want the Saindava, the horse, salt, water, and cup are brought. So that's a Saindava story from the Nirvana Sutra. So kind of about words and hidden meaning is in there. Now there's another story from the sutra in chapter 7 on page 60. Kashyapa, actually in this sutra, there's a Kashyapa Bodhisattva as well as Mahakashyapa, the Zen ancestor. But a lot of the conversation in the sutra is this layman Kashyapa Bodhisattva conversing with the Buddha. And here it's this Kashyapa Bodhisattva says, world honored one, Buddha, according to what you've said, all Buddhas speak with a hidden meaning. But this is not really what you mean, is it? Why? Because all Buddhas, world honored ones, have a hidden meaning, but not a hidden body of teaching. In other words, the Buddhas don't have any secret teaching. It's just that the meaning of the Buddha teaching sometimes seems to be hidden because it's subtle what they're talking about. I think this is what Kashyapa is saying. And the Buddha praised Kashyapa and said, very good. As you say, the Tathagata truly has no secret body of teachings. Why? Just as the full moon in autumn is clear and exposed in the sky, pure and unobscured and seen by everybody, so are the Tathagata's words. Everyone can read the sutra and hear the Buddha's words. The Buddha utters them clear and exposed, pure and unobscured. Deluded people say that there's a secret body of teachings, but the wise understand completely and don't call it a secret body of teaching. It just seems to be hidden. Like Saindava is not a secret. It's not a secret term. It just seems to be a little bit hidden what it actually means, until the attendant is quite intimate with the king and knows exactly what he's referring to when he says Saindava. So this story seems to be the basis for some other Zen ancestors, particularly in our lineage. Ancestor Yunju, we say Ungo Doyo Dayosho. An important Chinese ancestor in our Soto lineage. He was once asked by an imperial minister, kind of like a government official who was practicing Zen, and came to bring an offering to the temple. And the government official said, "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed to Kashyapa." He's referring to that conversation in the sutra they just had there. What was the world-honored one's kind of hidden speech, hidden meaning? Dogen has another whole essay based on these stories about this the Buddha having a hidden meaning, but Kashyapa not concealing it, realizing that it's not secret, and called intimate language in Kaz Ta-Nehisi's translation. So it's a kind of a loose translation. I think really it means more like almost like hidden or secret words. But intimate language is a nice way to talk about it also. So the government minister asked Ungo Doyo, "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it wasn't concealed to Kashyapa. What was the world-honored one's hidden speech?" And Ungo Doyo said, "Your Excellency." And he said, "Yes." And Ungo said, "Do you understand?" And the minister said, "No." And Ungo said, "If you don't understand, the world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning. If you do understand, it was not concealed to Kashyapa." This is the way our ancestors of our lineage sometimes talked. They were even willing to talk this way with like government officials. Then interestingly, I think, a little later, maybe five or six, seven, I don't remember exactly how many generations later in our Chinese Soto lineage, we have the 49th ancestor, Shui Do. So we, in our Japanese, we say Secho Chikan Dayosho. And he was practicing with Tendo Sogaku Dayosho. And one time, Tendo Sogaku was on Mount Tendo, Mount Tiantung, in China, and he entered the Zendo and maybe got up on the seat to give a Dharma talk and quoted this reference to the Parinirvana Sutra. "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed to Kashyapa." When Secho Chikan heard this, he suddenly awakened to its profound meaning. Standing there in the ranks with others, his tears fell. He unconsciously burst out, "Why haven't I heard this before?" Tendo Sogaku finished his talk and called in Secho Chikan to his Dokusan room and said, "Why were you weeping there during the Dharma talk?" And Secho said, "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed to Kashyapa." And Tendo Sogaku approved. There's something about how words are used to convey the teaching in a not such a direct way sometimes in Zen. Maybe this, because this sutra talks quite a bit about this kind of hidden storehouse and hidden meaning, but yet not secret and fully revealed, like the full moon in autumn. Maybe that's why the Zen ancestors liked this sutra and felt like there's something here about how do we express this teaching that's very hard to express. How can words hint at it without actually pointing right to it? Because we can't point right to it. Conditioned things we can point to. This is a piece of paper. But the unconditioned, we can't quite point right to it. So maybe we need this kind of hidden words. The World Honored One spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed. It was not hidden to Kashyapa. I've heard that there's a Zen ancestor named Wutsu Fayen, who was also asked once by a government official who was maybe kind of new to Zen, what is this Zen school all about? I know, you know, there's all these different Buddhist traditions, but what's so special about Zen? What's, you know, can you kind of sum it up for me? And Wutsu said, well, it's like there's this story that we have, kind of folk tale maybe in our culture. You know this one about there's this woman who is has a secret lover, and she's up in her room, and her parents don't want her to be with this man. But she can't talk to him directly because she'll get in trouble. But she wants to communicate with him. She wants him to know that she's there and that she's thinking of him. So how can I do this without my parents getting upset? I know he's down there below my window right now, hoping to catch a glimpse of me in the window. But my parents are right there across the room, and even if I go stand by the window, they'll know that I'm just standing there so he can see me. But I so long to connect with him. So she's like, this is what I'll do. I'll call my maid, whose name is Little Jade, and he'll hear my voice. I won't actually be talking to him directly, but he'll hear my voice. Little Jade, can you come here a minute? I have something to ask you. And then a few minutes later or something, oh, Little Jade, can you come? So she's calling her maid, but she's doing it for her lover outside the window. So he can hear her sweet voice. So that's what Wutsu said. That's how Wutsu explains Zen to this government official. So one last story from the short last piece from the a nice Zen story about the Parinirvana Sutra. This Zen ancestor Tai Yuan was in his later years was staying at the household of a lay supporter, Shang Shu. And one day Tai Yuan said to Shang Shu, you've been so kind to me, supporting me for these years. Tomorrow, to repay your kindness, I'll teach a passage from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra for you. And Shangxu was very happy about that. Next day, Shangxu offered some food and tea to Taiyuan. Taiyuan then sat down in the Dharma seat to speak. And he took up his kotsu stick and waved it and said, "Thus have I heard." And then Taiyuan called Shangxu. "Shangxu." And he said, "Yes." And Taiyuan said, "Buddha is this one single moment." And then Taiyuan died and entered parinirvana, passed away from this world. In the class, I don't think we would have time for these Zen stories about the sutras, so I brought them up tonight. And just one final last word. We have a brand new book out, and I'm going to advertise it. Entering the Mind of Buddha by Tenshin Reb Anderson Roshi. I haven't read it, but I'll recommend it anyway. It's on the Zen and the Six Heroic Practices of Bodhisattvas, also known as the Six Paramitas. And what do we say? Spoiler alert? I'm going to read the epilogue, the last page. Dogen's teacher Tian Tong wrote this poem about a wind bell that blows wherever it wants. So Tenshin Roshi, dear teacher, says, because I think it's related to our conversation tonight. Especially, this reminds me of the story of Saindava. "The wind bell is unconcerned with which direction the wind blows or how gently or strongly it's blowing. Like a Buddha, it responds appropriately to the conditions at hand. At times it offers sounds to signal the appropriate response. If the wind blows from the east, the bell moves west. It moves just the right amount given its weight, the earth's gravity, the strength of the wind, the temperature and humidity around it. In this process of responding to conditions, without picking and choosing, its chimes may touch each other and make a sound. Or the chimes may not touch, and therefore they'll make no sound. The wind bell has no preferences. It's beyond thinking. It has no fixed position. And because of that, it always responds appropriately to the given situation." Just like a Saindava person, a wise attendant. "It's like a spontaneously acting Zen master, responding appropriately and always singing the songs of perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas. I pray that our entire life, like the Buddhas, may be an appropriate response in face-to-face communion with all beings." Thank you, great disciples of Buddha, Saindava Assembly. May his merit equally extend to every being and place, so that all may realize Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them.